Hi, you're listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters for the week ending Friday the 13th of Feb. We're broadcast live on Triple R 102.7 from Melbourne, Wurundjeri Country, Australia. Coming up on this podcast, Bron takes us to a surprise party and Barry Cassidy shares his contribution to the new Oz Institute book, Bravery, What Happens When Australia Chooses Courage.
And it doesn't stop there. We had Simone Ubaldi in to review It Was Just an Accident, which is not an accident. We'll have her in as much as we can. And I had Dan and Jace try and help me solve a little mystery around a lamp.
Our game changer cutie, Jack Knight, indoctrinated us into the local release, Cult of the Lamb, Woolhaven, and comedian Nina Oyama poured her heart out ahead of the Valentine's Day event, Love Letters Live.
Triple R.
You're looking out, Girlfriend of the Year.
Yeah.
Thank you. Yeah, taking the award home.
Great week to be doing it.
Pretty good week, yeah.
Wow.
Pulled off a surprise party for Liz for her 40th on Saturday. It happened. Ended, I think, what has been just a hellish week for me. created my own personal hell by having to, like, run a group chat and organise something. But it's come off.
But did you shield that hard work? Is the, you know, is it emotional labour? At least does mine do the emotional labour of you complaining about the good time?
Yeah.
So did you had the good time and then you vented?
I let her know. As soon as we walked through the door and they said, surprise, I was like, this has been the worst week of my life.
Enjoy it.
Enjoy it, yeah. I'm going to go sit in a corner and drink now. Bye. Yeah, it was – she actually – I thought she had figured it out because Saturday morning she got up and she's like, I'm going shopping. I'm doing all the – and I was like, this is new.
To go out on your own.
Yeah, and like go – like she was like, I'm going to buy some – I'm gonna get myself a new outfit. I feel like it. And I was like, oh, she's on to me. But she actually just thought I was planning on proposing.
So you managed to disappoint her at the same time?
Yes.
Yeah,
so
good.
It was a bit of both, which is kind of nice. Yeah.
So you obviously that meant that she got wind that something was up.
Well, something was up, yeah. Obviously didn't keep – because she was like, you were just on your phone too much and you were doing weird things. So I didn't – yeah, I didn't do that good a job. But it's like – it is a kind of cruel exercise throwing a surprise party. It's like, oh, I've got to chat with all of your friends but you in it.
Yes.
And she was like, delete it. I don't want to know that exists.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then, yeah, it's such a big occasion. I guess there's a bit, like, those friends, there's a long history there.
Well, that's, yeah. And she, because it's her 40th, and everyone avoided her this week because they didn't want to be the one to, like, accidentally
spill the beans.
And she was like, no one is talking to me. I have no friends. Now, one person is asking, are you doing anything for your 40th? Do you want to grab a drink? She was really... It was kind of cruel, yeah.
Is there family around as well?
No, I didn't do family. I just did a few mates, small one, but it was nice.
Okay, and then what was the, how did the surprise come about?
Yeah, what's the big reveal?
Oh, the moment.
How'd you go?
Oh, okay. So I was like, everyone, we did, we went to a place in Preston, Jamshed. I don't know if you've been there. Very nice. I was like, all right, everyone get there just before 7. I'll get us there just after.
Okay.
So the ruse is we're meeting a couple of mates for dinner and that's it.
Yeah.
Two other friends. And I was like, I'll do something. I'll make us late so that it would be I didn't have to do anything. She's impossible to get out of the house. I was like, we need to be there now. And and then we walked in, everyone did the classic surprise.
Yes.
And then she cried. And
oh, that's nice. Like,
I know that felt good.
That's
that felt
brilliant.
Good. I made her cry on her birthday.
When you were approaching the venue, were you concerned that there might be cars on the street that would give it away?
I was a little, but I just snuck down a side street and it worked out.
Superb.
Oh, thank
clever.
You. Thank you, thank you. And then she was making life so difficult because as we're walking up, she's like, well, there's like tables outside. She's like, I actually think I want to sit outside. And I was like, well, we're not sitting outside. They just told me they have a table inside, so we've got to go inside. Why won't you go inside? Please go into the venue.
There's a function space in there.
Yes, yeah.
So she thought she was having dinner in some closet at the back.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Wicked, and then she burst into tears. That's
yes.
awesome.
Oh, so good. It was so good.
That's amazing.
What about speeches or anything? Like, in that moment, what happens? How does it calm down? Or how does it become into a normal party? Does it happen faster than you might expect?
Yeah, I think it happens pretty much immediately. All that has to happen is someone walks over with a glass of wine, and then it's like done. Everyone's back.
Yoo-hoo.
Yeah. And then you've got to do the rounds, say hello to everyone.
Is there anyone that you – how do you know that you're being thorough with the friends?
I got them vetted. I broke the friends into certain categories. And so she grew up in Bendigo. So the categories were lesbians, Bendigo, and then comedy, my comedy friends.
Amazing.
So then I sent the lesbian list to a lesbian. I said, are these all the lesbians? And then I sent the Bendigo list to a Bendigo mate. And I said, are these all the Bendigo people? Oh,
that's good.
And that was my big, yeah.
How's the, is it chalk and cheese, Bendigo and lesbian? Or it's a lot of crossover?
They hit it off. But they're getting a lot of messages from the lesbians yesterday being like, hey, Bliss, you're Bendigo mates are wild.
Were there many? How many Bendigo peeps made it down?
I had a few.
The number's not important, but necessarily. But was it that would have been a big shock?
Yes, it was. Like a mate drove all the way down from Yarrawonga for the night. So she was a big drive. She was already Sunday morning back cooking roast chooks for her kids. I mean, I don't know how she's done that. We haven't moved off the couch.
That's incredible.
I know, right?
Oh, that's slightly disturbing. Wow, like, that's on the highway.
What a gear shift.
It's crazy.
Lesbian she's, party in Preston, I know. Too.
People are amazing.
Chooks in Yarrawonga. Like, far out. I have no idea how she did it.
I take 45 minutes to get out of my car after I've parked it.
100%.
The transitions are so slow. She's doing hard pivots. Giving me whiplash just hearing about it.
She's doing roast dinner straight in. Oh, couldn't believe it. She sent photos, so we've got the proof. Unreal.
What about you? Did you you dressed up, but I suppose you didn't want to dress up so much that you gave the game away that it wasn't just a dinner.
Well, yeah. So it was just dressed up nice enough. I think that's the beauty of a party of lesbians. You can just wear jeans and a shirt.
Yeah,
and people are like, you look great.
What, did you have any close calls? Is there any moments where it was like, oh?
Yeah, there's a few moments where we ran into some friends on the street during the week and they almost did the see you Saturday. And yeah, there's a couple of those sort of things. And she was would mention a friend and I'd be like, oh, don't worry, we'll see them Saturday. And I'm like, shut up.
Gee.
I know.
That was such a bad mistake.
I know.
How did you get away with that one?
Oh, no, I didn't. I said, like, I almost said that so many times. Oh. But by the time I got to Friday, I was, like, kind of non-functioning. I couldn't talk. I was on edge. We kept fighting all week because I was just, like, so on edge. So I was glad to get it done.
Yeah.
I remember once my auntie had a surprise party. Maybe it was her 21st. And she was just – the party started – well, actually, we were – because we were the young cousins, we were tasked with hanging out with Auntie all day, keeping her occupied.
Oh, and yeah, the big job.
She was filthy. She was just so angry and disappointed that no one was doing anything for her birthday.
That's the thing about a surprise party is right up until it happens, they hate you.
I think I must have been about 10 years old and I was like, whoa, she's so stinky. It's actually a putrid smell. Like.
And did she love it when it happened?
Yeah, it's okay. That's the other gear shift, isn't it? Going from being so cranky that no one cares about you, everyone's doing other stuff to no, everyone cares. We're having a big party.
I did. One friend was like, I didn't want to tell you this during the week, but I threw a surprise party for my boyfriend and he nearly dumped me. So I was like, I have to find out more about that story. But yeah.
So you've shown yourself that you can do it. So does that mean that, because some people might go, oh, cool, I've unlocked a part of my personality and now I can proceed with this skill set. Whereas you're like, it seems like, well, I've shown myself I can do it, therefore I never have to do it again.
That's the feeling, I've done it and I knew I'd hate it and I did. And that's confirmed. But I think the other thing that's lucky is like people – that's lucky. No, but people really like my partner list. So they were happy to show up, you know, and it was easy to get people to help out and do stuff.
Oh, it never occurred to me there'd be people for whom you would throw a surprise party, you have to twist people's arm.
Oh, there would be.
Yeah.
There'd be someone, right? Yeah. I mean, a friend, one of my friends came up to me at the party and was like, happy to do this for Liz. Probably wouldn't do it for you.
Wow. That's hilarious. All right. Let's.
Yeah, come on.
Here on Breakfasters. What a weekend, too.
Oh, my God.
Midsummer, rolling into Pride.
Oh, yeah, we had big plans to go to Pride. We couldn't move.
Too busy cooking roast chooks and Bendigo.
Exactly.
Triple R on FM, digital, online, and via the app.
Barry Cassidy is a veteran political journalist, former prime ministerial staffer, author of books including The Party Thieves, Private Bill and An Ocean of Cricket, creator of ABC TV's Insiders, which he held for 18 years, recipient of the Melbourne Press Club's Lifetime Achievement Award for his outstanding contribution to political journalism, and is current chair of the Museum of Australian Democracy at Old Parliament House. Barry has contributed an essay to a new anthology from the Australian Institute titled A Time for Bravery, What Happens When Australia Chooses Courage, and to tell us about it, the precocious sports reporter turned giant of Australian politics and media joins us now. Barry, welcome back to Breakfasters.
Hey! Thank you.
JC is from Albury. Was there a journalistic start in that area?
Yeah, that's where I started my cadetship as a journalist back in 1969. So I did the whole of my cadetship in Albury. I was from a country town very nearby, Chilton, and so Albury was the starting point.
So you're in the Kathy McGowan's home seat, but also Farrah, which is Susan Leigh.
Yes, though at the time it was a very different situation. There was no question about who got elected in Indi back then. It was whoever the Liberal Party put up.
Well, things can change, can't
they? Got elected, and now Indi kind of led the charge, really, in terms of the move towards the teal type independence.
I'll tell you a quick story, actually. So in high school, politics class, we didn't like the sound of towing the party line. It was a bit of a discussion in our politics class. Anyway, one of the girls in our class, Leah Ginnivan, told her auntie to run as an independent against the incumbent. And that was Kathy McGowan.
Yeah. Well, the McGowans, they have a stand-up start because I think she's got 10 or 11 siblings.
She does. Yeah, yeah. Big family.
You'd have to get back in those
votes. It's a pretty strong vote, isn't it?
Persuasive niece there as well. Yeah. Wow.
But that point, towing the party line, it really was a kind of the bedrock to it, really, that what was wrong with the system was that no matter who, if you get elected as a Liberal or Labor, in the end they go to Canberra and they tow the party line.
Yeah.
And they do, and you don't get this independent thinking. And that's what they brought to the process.
So to invoke, I suppose, the theme of the book, what is the woolly line between discipline and bravery?
Yeah, it's a time for bravery, but it there are about 30 contributors, and they come at all sort of different angles. And my brief was to talk about bravery in terms of economic reform. And so basically, my thesis is that. That it often fails when the push comes from opposition. Simon Crean, John Hewson tried reform, of course, and spectacularly failed, and Bill Shorten around negative gearing and so on. But those, and then you look at the period when after Gillard and Rudd, the coalition had 9 years of government, but three prime ministers. So you didn't have the political stability. So what you need is you need incumbency. So that's Hawke, Keating, Howard. You need incumbency and you need the political stability. And the three of them had political stability. And now Anthony Albanese has it in spades, right? Not only is he politically ascendant, but there's virtually no opposition right at the moment. So now is the time for reform, and reform is desperately needed.
The nugget you've put in here of John Hewson and JSD not getting up because the timing wasn't right, but then the timing changed and John Howard got it over the line. There's some policies that maybe Labor hasn't had the timing for, but maybe the timing is now?
Absolutely. It certainly is. And look, the big one, and I think they're now accepting it, and you certainly hear it from Jim Chalmers, is the intergenerational inequality. The fact that young people today just don't get the breaks that the boomers got. And the most significant aspect of that is around housing. But it goes a lot further than that. It's the whole taxation system. Mm-hmm. Rather than give younger people who are really just relying on all of their income to get by, rather than giving them, you need to give them a tax break, obviously, and the wages at that lower level are about to be improved, I think, for 18, 19, 20-year-olds. But beyond that, it's the housing market is now almost impossible for them. But on the other side of the ledger, what they're still doing is giving tax breaks to investors. And they talk about aspiration, you know, we can't, you know, we can't interfere with the aspiration. Is there a need, while people are struggling to get into housing, to give other people taxation breaks to invest?
Mm.
And that's what happened. And the moment you talk about taking away some of these incentives, some of these taxation breaks like negative gearing or whatever, or the capital gains tax, you know, there's an outcry, and it probably cost Bill Shorten the election when he ran in 2019. So it's I think that's where they will look. Mm. It's when you look at the capital gains tax benefits, for example. That 60% of the money, taxpayers' money that's spent on that or denied to taxpayers go to 1%, the top 1%.
Wow.
And so that's where they really, you've got to start there and start, because that has a direct impact on the cost of housing.
Does that, I guess, bravery, there's lots of talk throughout the book about exercising the bravery muscle, exercising the courage muscle. I guess we used to be a nation that invested a lot in innovation, coming up with new ideas. You can invest in a house, but it's not exactly the bravest choice, is it?
No, and coming up with new ideas is fine.
Yeah.
I mean, that's and governments will do that from time to time, and often there's no political downside.
Mm.
The key to this is accept the political downside occasionally. Accept that it's going to hurt some people, and they'll squeal, and they'll probably be the more influential people with more access to the media than the younger people who will benefit. And so you've got to accept you have to take a hit occasionally,
yeah,
if you want to get things done. And that's why you do need to be, I think, in a strong position politically to be able to wear that.
I mean, there are only, 151 seats in the House of Reps? Is it difficult to... What are the odds that we get Australia's best? You've canvassed this for five decades. What can you assess the rise and the ebbing and flowing or the competence level of the Parliament?
I suppose overall, comparing one parliament to one in the past is a little more difficult. They were better parliaments in the past because I think they had a greater spread of interests and political approaches in the past, certainly in the coalition and within the Liberal Party. Back in the Fraser and Howard days, there was a much greater spread of ideas and ideology than there is now. So it's a bit difficult. I think you can compare parties over the years, but it's a little harder to compare parliaments. But at the moment, when you talk about 151 seats, well, Labor has 94 of them, and that's the point.
Mm-hmm.
They're dominant, and the polls suggest right now that they won't go backwards at the next election. And for a third, that would be a third election for Anthony Albanese, and to not go backwards in a third election would be almost unprecedented.
Yeah. What about the primary vote being low? Does it matter? Is it just like, well, a win's a win?
Yeah, sure matters. The primary vote matters. The two-party preferred in the end determines your numbers. But the primary vote is absolutely key to it. And look, you look at the... there is an argument that... it's genuine. It's there for everybody to see that there's been a falling away of support for the major parties now over 40 or 50 years. At the 2013 election, the coalition got 46% of the primary vote. Now, 2013, that's only 12 years away. Mm. You know, ago, 46%. They then got at the last election 32%. So that's in real votes. That's a big collapse. But the most astounding thing about the latest opinion polls, and if you compare polls rather than election results, 3 months before the last election, so that's exactly 1 year ago, February last year, the opinion polls on average were showing the coalition a 41% primary vote. 3 months later, they got 32% in the election.
Ooh, okay.
And now they're at 18. So that's in 1 year. This is not a gradual thing. That is falling off the cliff in spectacular style. It's easy, I think, to kind of identify what has gone on over the last 40 years or what has gone on over the last 15 years to bring about a disappointment with the performance of the major parties. It's almost impossible to identify what has happened over a 12-month period for that kind of decline in a vote from 41% to 18%. Now, sure, it's the rise of One Nation in an extent, but why?
Mm.
Why has One Nation gone from 6 or 7% at the last election to 27% now? What has happened to bring that about? Now, you can come up with a whole range of kind of at-the-edges issues, you know, like all of the things that went wrong in the election campaign and all the internal dissents that's going on within the coalition. But we've had that before. Had those sorts of things happen before. It's never led to this kind of spectacular decline in the vote. So I think that's the challenge, just, you know, what has happened? Donald Trump happened. Yeah. Now, maybe there's an impact there because there's a sense that Peter Dutton, certainly during the election campaign, was adopting some of his language and some of his ideas. He certainly wasn't condemning very much about Donald Trump. Maybe it's that the Gaza happened. Now, what has been the impact of that on the electorate? You've got to look for the big things.
Mm. What are the? You mentioned the 1% before that getting the tax breaks. Where does say the? There's a bit of speculation about the Clive Palmer $60 million?
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Like that 1%. Where do they get too much of the microphone?
Well, he doesn't get a lot of the microphone, but what he gets is a lot of advertising space.
Mm.
Where Palmer had a major impact in the election between Scott Morrison and Bill Shorten was that he was spending all of this money, and then he realised very late in the piece that he wasn't going to get a seat. You know, he's spending $70 or $80 million and not winning a single seat. So what he decided to do over the last couple of weeks was just attack Labor and attack Bill Shorten, and so that had an impact. Of course, that's going to have an impact if you're not selling yourself, which people weren't buying.
Yeah.
So what you do then is you attack one of the major players. And that had a significant impact, and that would have carried a lot of votes at the last minute.
Is the political atmosphere right now conspicuously febrile, or is that just recency bias?
Is the political atmosphere overall?
Mm-hmm.
Look, I suppose it is in a sense, but when you've got an opposition falling apart, it doesn't. There's no translation to that in the parliament. It's also so one-sided. And when there's an expectation, and you rarely get this in Australian politics, but a very strong expectation that the government of the day is going to be elected again, and even potentially with an increased majority, it takes the heat right out of politics. But the issues, the really, the difficult emotional issues, are around things like the war in Gaza and the way that it was prosecuted and how that plays out here in Australia, and you know the Herzog visit to Australia is one that's they said it was designed to bring about unity, but how can it possibly do that when there are such divided opinions on the way that Netanyahu and Israel have carried out the war in Gaza? Of course, it's going to inflame passions, and of course people are going to turn up and protest. They would have known that, and they knew it to the extent that they brought out special laws to deal with one individual, against protests against an individual, which we haven't seen in the past. So there are issues, but in
could,
a way
could you call that decision brave?
crazy brave. Look, it just seems to me that if The Jewish community, the whole motivation behind it is the Jewish community, Australian Jews needed comfort at this stage. Get that 100%, and that ought to be taken care of. But provided the visit is not used in any sense as propaganda to shore up the actions of the Israeli government in Gaza, And so what happens, you don't invite, for whatever reason, the chief rabbi from Israel to come and comfort Australian Jews. You invite an elected president who's a politician, in effect. And you say he's head of state, but the president in Israel is elected by the Knesset, right, in a majority vote, a simple majority. So it's a different situation, and he does constantly talk about politics, and he defends the way that the Israeli government has prosecuted the war. And even before he arrived in Australia, the Australian had a front-page lead saying, quoting him as saying that Australians have been brainwashed and we ought to have a better understanding of why Israel does what it does. That's politics.
Yeah.
And so, you know, to me, it's, I don't think that the idea that a politician, in effect, and that's what he is, should be the person to come out at a time when you've got the government, the federal government of the day, saying that we don't want people bringing ancient battles to our shores. So I think they misjudged on this. They've had to, as I said, strike special legislation to deal with it. And so, therefore, it was obvious in their minds that it was going to be divisive.
Mm. We've been speaking with Barry Cassidy on the publication of the new anthology from the Australian Institute titled A Time for Bravery. People, you know, they love you, they want more of you. Is there anywhere we can listen or hear or see you? What's your 2026 looking like? It looks like the chairmanship of the museum is coming to winding up for you.
Yes, though there's always a prospect of a reappointment. Oh, okay. So I know what we've got the centenary of Old Parliament House coming up in May next year.
Wow.
And so that's a pretty big deal. I'd love to be around for that, but this is not a job application. But when you say, listen, I've got a podcast on The Guardian, mm-hmm. And it comes out every Saturday with Tony Barry, who's a former strategist for the Liberal Party and now a pollster. And it's called Back to Back Barry, so that podcast is there every week, and I look forward to doing that.
Beautiful. And your kids are getting into the media as well.
Yeah, my daughter Caitlin is at The Guardian.
Yeah.
She's the education reporter, though she branches out and does a whole lot of things these days.
Did you warn her not to follow your footsteps?
she wasn't persuaded for a long time.
Yeah, right.
She's not a huge fan of how the media operates overall. I think that was part of the problem.
Yeah, exactly.
But she's embraced it now and manages to work within the system. And my son is diversity and inclusion with the Sports Commission. That's been his career. He's done it with Cricket Australia and other organisations.
Well, you must be very proud, and it's a big year for you, and it's always a pleasure to check in with you, Barry Cassidy. And we, as usual, only scratch the surface. I want to hear more about your sport reporting days as a bloody teenager as well. What a precocious little guru you were at the time.
Well, we'll look for a key sporting event and then we can come in and talk sport.
Love that. All right, very kind of Steve. Thanks very much, mate.
Triple R on FM, digital, online and via the app.
We're here talking film on a Thursday with cinephile and frequent flyer Simone Ubaldi. Morning, Simone.
Good morning. Hello.
Welcome back.
Thank you so much. Happy 2026, everybody.
Yeah.
Kyla, how many years have we been running that sting for this segment?
Well, it's yours. You said that you...
Belongs to I.
You suggested it.
I did. It was from a film that follows, so I could figure out when It Follows came out and then we would know.
Oh, okay.
It's good though.
Well, it actually kind of makes me a bit stressed.
Yeah, no, it does.
That film is stressful.
It's deeply inappropriate for the hour between the hours of 7 and 8 in the morning, which is, I think, appropriate for me.
What do you want to talk about?
Well, oh man, it was a very rich summer of movies and I hope everyone went to see a bunch of them because it was a very beautiful and emotional time. The one that I'm going to talk about, it was just an accident, the much acclaimed Iranian film that took out the Palme d'Or at Cannes last year and actually the top prize at Venice and Berlin, making Jafar Panahi one of, I think, just three or four filmmakers who have won all three, along with Robert Altman and Antonioni and some other guy.
What's more critical than that?
So the film is about a group of people who come together. It sort of opens on this kind of dark and dusty road somewhere on the outskirts of Tehran where a man is driving with his daughter and wife and they accidentally hit a dog, which triggers a series of events where that man ends up in the workshop of a mechanic who thinks that he recognises from the sound of his irregular gait the man as a prison guard who tortured the mechanic while he was held in a Tehran prison. The man, whose name is Vahid, he kidnaps the mechanic, whose name is Vahid, kidnaps the man, who he refers to as Pegleg, and then essentially kind of gathers a group of people around him who also experienced torture in a Tehrani prison to see if he can verify his identity with the hopes of exacting revenge. And each person that he kind of pulls in who has had this experience of torture has different kinds of trauma attached to that. They become this ragtag crew. They all have different ways of... None of them... They're all blindfolded, so none of them could recognise by sight Pegleg, but they all have different means and memories that they use to try and identify him. But ultimately, the film is... It's about a lot of things. It's about the kind of political landscape of Iran, but it is also about the nature of memory and the role of revenge in triggering an endless cycle of violence between an oppressive religious regime and people who are just trying to live their lives underneath it.
Unbelievable.
Yeah, it's really
good. How ambitious.
It's really good. Well, the other thing about this film that's... Were you about to ask me something, Dan? The other thing about the film that's kind of much discussed is that the film was made in secret. There's the political context of how the film was made and the creative context of the Panahi's career is super interesting, and there are some really great articles out there about it. But basically, he himself was imprisoned in 2010 after having he won, you know, the top prize at Cannes for a debut film. He's made lots of acclaimed movies. He was imprisoned in 2010. For several months and tortured himself and then had this suspended six-year sentence kind of hanging over his head. He was banned from making films, banned from leaving the country. So Jafar has had this... I mean, these bans were lifted in 2022, but then he went back into prison. He made this film, it was just an accident, without the necessary permits, in secret with this kind of small rogue crew that was just kind of driving around the streets of a very identifiable Tehran, shooting two or three takes very quickly with tiny cameras, avoiding the religious police who, you know, based on what I've seen in the film, are people who just need to be kind of paid various bribes at different times. And then the film was kind of smuggled out. It was edited. The post was done in France, Iran, with the Academy Awards. The actual government has to be the one to submit the films for the Academy Awards for Best Foreign Film. Iran, of course, would not. So France did, because the post-production was done in France and it's been nominated for Best International Film. But in the meantime, Jahani is still living in Iran. He kind of moves in and out of the country and he's like, they can't take me down. It's got very, very, very high profile. He starred in previous films that he made that had huge international acclaim, these weird kind of docudrama hybrids. So he's a really high-profile person. He's still living there. He made this film without permission. It's garnered all this international acclaim, and it is profoundly critical of the Iranian regime. So, like, there's a lot going on around this film, in addition to the fact that it's this beautifully crafted ensemble, almost dramedy, because there's actually quite a lot of, like, levity and humour.
I got to say, the premise sounds pretty bleakly funny.
It is. It's bleakly funny, and the characters really kind of lift and bring that to life in the way that it's scripted and the way that it's shot, often in long takes. So you see these people kind of fumbling around each other with their different kinds of trauma, but very quickly. It's quite poetic. Like, it's really engrossing.
There's something about, like, off the top of my head, I'm just thinking another film like that was 7 Years in Tibet, where they filmed in secret.
The Brad Pitt, what is the Brad Pitt one about the Dalai Lama?
Yes, I think, or that era, yeah. There's something about capturing the, like, you can't recreate that in a studio, can you?
No. Well, No. I'm going to say there is a lot of incredible Iranian cinema. There's a really long tradition of like 100 years worth of filmmaking in Iran, and many acclaimed Iranian films that have emerged out of that. Seed of a Sacred Fig last year, A Separation, the Kiarostami films. So there's, you know, Westerners have a lot of opportunity to kind of see what life is like under the kind of regime on film. But particularly in light of the current political climate, and this film was made obviously before the horrors that have kind of befallen protesters in Iran, but for me, even if it wasn't as great a film as it is, to have the opportunity to see a really pointed political film that's really pointedly about the regime as opposed to being scenes of small domestic life that are occurring underneath it, just felt, was just, it felt incredibly culturally valuable to hear those voices, to hear the voices of resistance.
Without being like homework.
Without it being homework, still being a really enjoyable cinema experience. And if he hadn't had the kind of capacity, courage, and I guess the power that he has as a cultural figure to make this movie the way that he did, you wouldn't get to see that.
Mm. And what about the idea? I mean, because I'm having a look at the poster, which is incredibly striking, but I can't imagine, as you've described it, there's a lot of time to sit around waiting for the perfect light.
No, they shot a lot of it in natural light, as a matter of fact. So apparently he travels with like a cinematographer and editor and edits on the fly, but like lots of long single shots. Like, he's really a master filmmaker. He's been making movies since, I believe, the mid-90s. A lot of his films, although I haven't seen them, I just know this because I've read this, play with kind of formalist structure quite a bit. But, yeah, clearly a... incredibly masterful filmmaker who's incredibly resourceful as well.
Mm. And you sort of person who tries to guess where it's going, or you just let it just get on the roller coaster? And
I don't try, it just happens. We all do. Like, you watch a lot of movies, your brain just moves forward.
Yeah.
I did not necessarily see where this film was going. And I have to say, not that it doesn't matter, but for me, like, the climax of this film did not land for me. This is like a critically adored movie. That often happens with a smaller foreign film coming out of France, and then there's sometimes not pushback. The climax, I was like, this is like the weakest part of the movie. But I think that it is morally courageous where it goes, and it leaves the viewer with questions, which is really nice.
Yeah, nice. Mm. It was just an accident.
Mm-hmm.
Love it.
Mm-hmm.
Where is it?
It's in all the good small cinemas. It's all the good little ones.
Get the small ones are always the best,
aren't
they?
Get in there before Jacob Elordi's moist eyes blow up the screen.
Love it. Okay, it was just an accident. Simone Ubaldi, great to see you again.
You too, guys.
Triple R.
I've got a bit of a mystery going on at home.
Mm.
See if you can help me solve it. There is... okay. In the car park in our building, the car parked beside us for an entire year now has had a lamp in the car.
Hang on. It's just sitting there.
Just in the, yeah. Sometimes it moves seats. Okay. I've seen it in every seat but the driver's seat.
Really?
Yeah.
That's weird.
In it, yeah, it's like a full table lamp, base end shade.
Okay. Like a old school 70s, 80s kind of one?
Yeah, like something you'd find in a roadside motel or maybe hard rubbish, I would say.
Awesome.
And it sits in the car every day.
Moves around.
Moves around the car, but is always there.
Okay.
And I don't know what possible need you would have to transport a lamp with you.
I wonder...
everywhere you went.
Is it like an old school... car as well, and you can plug the lamp into the cigarette lighter. It's like an old Datsun or something. You reckon
that's the workaround, like the car light's gone out.
I reckon that's what that is. So the door light's not working.
The door light's not working, you reckon?
And they've adapted the lamp that would plug into the cigarette lighter.
I mean, it's a wild decision when you do have a torch on your phone. Also, they've made portable, like, even if you didn't have an iPhone, you could just have a torch.
This crew's, they're not Amish, but they're Amish 2.0. They're not getting phones. They're sticking by the lamp. What wheels?
Just really pro-lamp, just like, I'm never giving it up.
Yeah, they're very beautiful ornaments.
And I mean, I say a year, but that's as long as we've been there. So the lamp predates our move into the building. So it was there when we got there.
Could have been there since the 70s.
Don't know. Yeah.
And so you're...
Maybe it never made it out of the car the day they bought it. <It's> just... They left it in.
And you're prying in every time you go past.
Yes, every time. Now I'm obsessed. So whenever I park the car, have to go down to the garage, have a little peek in, see where the lamp is in the car, go back and report back, say, it's in the passenger seat today.
Oh, bit of movement.
I mean, this is the thing, because people, they move into a house and then they leave a stack of, I don't know, magazines or cutlery or something, and then they never get around to it. Like a lot of things that you think you'll fix, you'll never get around to.
Mm.
And this placeholder situation persists in perpetuity for some reason for a lot of people. But a lamp in a car seems like an easy fix.
Seems like such an easy fix. You don't even have to take it up to the house. There's a storage cage right next to your car. Put it in there.
Yeah, because you don't even need to turn them on. They can just sit there.
Yes.
Looking pretty, you know?
And then people must get in the car and they have to move it around. They go, because I imagine that's why it's moving around the car. So they pick someone up. They go, oh, I'll move the lamp.
Mm.
And you never put in the boot even. It's never even made it to the boot.
Because I would have thought that also the globe would be pretty fragile. Like, you know, the filament get knocked around and it'll, you know, we're destroying the lamp.
Well,
it sounds like is a lucky lamp.
Maybe. Is it lucky? Is it sentimental? Has it been passed down?
I don't know. You break suddenly and then you got this lamp thrashing around.
like that's grandma's lamp.
Do you buckle it up? It's like a ready lamp?
I haven't seen it buckled up. I'll keep an eye out for that. But yeah, maybe it's, I don't, unless like, there's somewhere they go and they're like, I need the lamp. I'll take it back.
Yeah, that's what I'm kind of hoping. There's like a secret get-together somewhere in the park or something and everyone sits around a circle around this lamp.
Or are they plugging it in? They don't even need to. It's just more about the lamp.
They've probably got one of those things that goes direct to the car battery and discharges a really long extension cord right through the
park. Maybe the lamp came with the car.
Yeah.
I mean, I would sometimes have things in the car and it's like, well, I'm not going directly to where this thing belongs, but eventually I'll arrive there, which is what you...
Yeah.
But a year is a long time.
It's a long time. So do you reckon they've been meaning to drop it around to a mate's place?
Yeah.
Every time they get there, they forget to get it out of back in the car.
No, they haven't been to the mate's place.
They're holding out hope that they're still friends.
Waiting for an invite. Yeah, exactly.
Maybe it's an ex.
Yeah.
they're just waiting for that call and they're like, do you know what? Actually, I've still got the lamp. Do you want me to bring the lamp around?
Yeah, maybe. Or maybe it's a lamp that's in dispute.
It could
be like someone else's, I don't know, there's been a share house that's been dissolved, a couple that's broken up or something.
They've hidden it in the car. So they come around, they go, I don't have the lamp. Come have a look.
Go upstairs, look.
Look, have a look.
You know, have you heard of blue boating? So
I have not.
So if someone commissions an artwork, you're the artist, you'll put in a little blue boat that's aberrant and incongruous and it really shouldn't be there. And then the person who's bought the artwork goes, love the painting, just get rid of the blue boat.
Mm-hmm.
And then the artist goes, cool, because I was going to get rid of the blue boat anyway, but now the person who's paid for it feels like they've been involved.
Right.
And so I wonder, is the lamp like a signal to thieves? Like, this is all I got. Like, you're really going to break in here for a lamp?
It's their blue boat.
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Oh, that's a good one. I guess, yeah, I mean, the blue boat in our car is lots of fast food wrappers. they're probably getting out of their car every day and being like, yikes, I hope they're okay.
We need clean up. Help us with the clean up.
Yeah.
Like if there is a weird blue, if there is a weird lamp, you're just completely distracted from the backpack in the back seat.
Yeah. Yeah, if you see the lamp, you're like, I don't think they're doing that well.
Yeah.
I don't think
something's weird here.
Do you think you'd feel bad? You'd be like, oh, they don't need me robbing them.
Yeah.
Just leave $10 under the windscreen wiper.
The loose lamp. Go on.
Go get yourself a feed.
Yeah.
I wonder, what era of wheels are we talking here? Is it like, what's the car?
Are they doing...
That is a great question. I would describe myself as having a kind of a form of car blindness where I could not tell you a make or model. It's black,
are
I
you,
think.
Are you going to ask if the situation arises where the owner of the car... Or has a situation arisen and you've not...
We've engaged? Never run into them. Also, I'm a massive coward, so probably not. I'll run.
Is it with the car, is it like one that would have electric windows? Is it like a hybrid?
I reckon...
Is it like...
Yeah, I reckon you've got...
Is it a Model T Ford?
She doesn't know. She says she's blind.
Look, I've tried to get into cars that aren't mine just because they're the same colour.
Yeah, yeah, right.
Yeah, that's where I'm at. I reckon it has electric windows.
Okay, so it's not like...
But not fancy. Ancient. It's not ancient, but it's not...
It's not new. Brand new.
Yeah.
Okay.
Same with... But the lamp is ancient.
Mm, I wonder if they're like a sentimental person. Maybe. Yeah, I don't know.
You can be sentimental and lug around a lamp in your car.
It's a really...
There's a middle ground.
Valentine's Day.
It's a really important lamp. Yeah. I cannot.
I know, because it's like you think that like, yeah, maybe they're sentimental, but then they're just leaving it abandoned in the car every night. You don't want it with you? It's good enough to have in the car and take everywhere you go, but then... It can't have a home.
Yeah. It's feuding with the lamps inside. Yeah.
Maybe they just don't like giving people lifts. And they're just like, sorry.
Sorry. Oh, God, got the lamp.
Still in the middle of my 50-year move.
Couldn't possibly fit you in.
Bummer. Sorry.
Damn.
Well, yeah, if you've got any ideas, maybe it's... Maybe you're missing a lamp.
Maybe, yeah. I know where it is.
Triple R.
For Game Changers this week, we're joined by the suitably gentle Jack Knight. Morning, Jack.
Good morning. How are we doing this morning?
Really swell. Good to see you as always.
Yes, thank you. Well, yes, in the past kind of week or so, I've been playing a new game. What I've actually been playing is an expansion pack to an original game. So nowadays it's kind of called a DLC, downloadable content. And so the game that I've been playing is Cult of the Lamb. And the expansion pack is Woolhaven.
Now, is this one of the biggest games from a few years ago?
Yeah, exactly. So Cult of the Lamb was actually made back in 2022, so a little bit ago. And normally I wouldn't necessarily come and talk about an expansion pack, but it's actually a Melbourne-based... the developers are from Melbourne, so I thought it's probably worthwhile getting the word out there. It was a huge smash hit, Cult of the Lamb, when it came out, and they've done amazing things with this expansion pack as well.
Do you know what years games came out just instinctively? You know,
no.
Like people do with albums?
Not at all, actually. my mind is terrible for that. I very much have to go look it up. But some of them are very much reminiscent of the times, especially ones around like lockdowns and stuff.
That's what I thought.
Yeah, and this is kind of, I mean, 2022, like it's still got reminiscent of that. And it's got the, I think one of the things that came out of that was a lot of like cozy kind of games. And this has got the cozy kind of vibes.
Oh.
So the whole idea with Cult of the Lamb is that you play as a lamb. And at the very beginning of the base game, which I'll kind of recap quickly, you essentially get sacrificed to appease these four gods.
Cozy.
And very cozy. Yeah. So there's like this whole thing of, I'm going to say, very contradictory things that are very uncozy, but the whole graphics and the feel of the game is very cartoony, and all of the characters have these massive eyes, and everything is actually very cute, contradicted by all of this sacrifice and cult rituals and all of this stuff. So... you get sacrificed, and in the afterlife, you are saved by this old god that basically cuts you a deal and says, look, I'll let you live as long as you start a cult in my name and bring me to power, kind of thing. So the whole idea of the base game is that you go and defeat these gods that are holding this other god back, and that's kind of how you complete the game. So the whole idea of the game is that you go and do these little battles, you come back in between battles, and you kind of maintain your cult, and you expand your little town and recruit more followers and this kind of thing. So it's got this whole like kind of like town management aspect to awesome. It as well, which is very fun.
Does anyone cotton on that you're just a mercenary doing it to stay alive?
No. Everyone's hook, line, and sinker. They're all massive in the faith.
You yourself are not in the faith?
No, I guess I am. I guess you do play as someone that is a cult leader.
And
really, they are actually kind of bowing to you necessarily.
Sweet. Are there any fires you have to put out in the cult?
Yes, there are definitely dissenters, but you will eventually be able to build a prison and re-educate. yes. So there's a lot of kind of like moral dilemmas that I guess are brought up in the game. You get to choose between one ritual where you convince all of the followers that they are able to eat just a grass meal and they're happy and satisfied with that. Or you could also choose that they can eat a cannibalistic meal, and that will give different points in a different way. And so you kind of have to choose between these two kinds of options. And I never have the heart to do any of the mean stuff, so they were all eating grass and having a lovely time. But that's kind of the way the base game is. And so the expansion has really added on two different, biomes or different kind of like routes that you can take to do battles. And it has brought forth an entire new area called Woolhaven. So this, if anyone's played the base game, the expansion is kind of done at the very end of the game. So you need to basically have completed the original game to kind of get access to this, even if you've already paid for the expansion. And what happens is that you go into Woolhaven and there is another god that is friendly called Yunya. I don't really know how to pronounce it. Mm-hmm. And she has basically said that she has had lots of followers and they've all perished and they need to be kind of like brought back to her, and that there is a mountain called Yufall, and this mountain is basically being corrupted by this rot that is going on. And while all of this is happening, the seasons are also changing. So in the base game, nothing to do with seasons. It was always sunny and always nice. Now winter creeps around every now and again. So what you need to do is you need to be able to go and fight the hordes off on Yufall on this mountain and be able to collect certain resources to then bring back to your base to keep a furnace burning so that when winter comes, all of your little followers are happy and safe. And one of the other aspects, so they've brought in a couple of new features as well. So one of them is once you've brought back a certain number of followers to Yunya, they will actually resurrect some buildings in Woolhaven. And one of them is, for example, a place where you're able to tame animals. And so you're able to start doing some farming of animals, really. And so
lamb is the farmer.
Yes, exactly. So the lamb is the farmer, which is all very...
It should be.
Yeah, exactly. And so you can kind of feed your pets and shave them and get wool and this kind of thing. You can also, if winter gets dire, you can also eat the animals, which is, you know, again, something that I'm trying not to do in my game. So basically, if you enjoyed the first game, this second one is really going to, it's not a second game, it's this expansion, but it's really going to bring back a lot of the feelings that you might have enjoyed from the
film. Can I just regurgitate what you... It sounds like a cutesy, dark satire on brainwashing.
It's basically what it is.
Awesome.
And speaking of brainwashing, there is also a ritual in the original game where you're able to actually feed all of your followers mushrooms, and then for the next 3 days you can do what you want and they're happy with it. So, yeah, there's a lot of, like, dark humour, I guess, kind of, like, sewn into the game as well, which is very fun.
How long does it take to play, do you reckon?
The original game probably took me about 20 hours or so, and I reckon that this expansion has probably got another 10. There's a lot of, like, extra content that you can kind of go and choose to do if you want to. Yeah, I would say probably about 10.
All right, and where do we play Cult of the Lamb Wallhaven?
It is available out on Steam, PlayStation, Xbox. Anywhere where the original game was is able to be out there as well.
All right, Jack Knight. Sorry, go on, Jase.
Oh, yeah, maybe just before we go, there was, tragically, the creator of the music for the original game is no longer with us, also a local artist.
Yeah, exactly. Riverboy was the producer of the music in the original game and sadly passed away last year. Some of the music has actually been brought forward and is incorporated into the expansion. There's also a character that they've kind of immortalized him in the game. So in the game, your followers kind of, like, reach a certain age and they pass away. But in Riverboy is eternal and just kind of doesn't work, hangs out and just plays the flute all day and has a lovely time.
That's gorgeous.
So, yeah, it's really nice.
Jack Knight, ethical, even as an avatar. thank you. Cult of the Lamb, Wallhaven is the game. Thanks very much, mate.
Thank you.
Melbourne's own Triple R.
Nina Oyama is a writer, director, comedian and actor whose credits include Deadlock on Amazon Prime, ABC TV's Utopia, as well as being a panel member on Taskmaster Australia, the voice of Perky Sea Dragon Pip in the animated film The Pow Pow Fish, and co-creating the actor award-winning SBS series Latecomers. The stand-up is appearing this Valentine's Day at the State Library in the event Love Letters Live. And to tell us about it, the aspiring dancer and undisciplined napper joins us now. Nina, welcome back to Breakfasters.
Hello, I feel like that was a comprehensive rundown of my entire life.
Yes, this is your
That's
life.
Incredible. Thank you. I feel great now. It's all the highlights.
Are you a romantic, do you think?
Oh, yeah, I think so. I believe in love.
Nice.
Yeah.
How many times have you been in love?
How many times? Oh, that's so brutal. Like one? Like I think I thought answer. I was in love lots of times, but I think, yeah, I'm with someone now and I feel very strong. I was like, oh, okay, all those other times were fake. They were like a rehearsal for this.
Yeah. It's divorce season, apparently. February is when people get divorced. Well, it's interesting.
Why did you bring this up?
Wait, because you're in love.
I'm like, Daniel, I'm in love. And you're like, that's divorce season. Okay.
But we're speculating with people. They don't, you know, Valentine's Day is a day. You want to break up before Valentine's Day.
Yeah, I guess so. But maybe, like, you know, just make a meal of it, you know? A last hurrah, a last dinner.
Yeah.
A farewell tour.
Do you think it depends, like, who's footing the bill?
Oh.
Like, if you're footing the bill, maybe break up before Valentine's Day. But yeah. If it's one last free meal.
That's true.
Hold on.
It also depends on how much you like or don't like the person, I think. Like, if you have stopped having a good time with them, then, like...
But if you get one more, like, entree, meal, dessert...
You're going in three
fine
courses.
Dining.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. That's genius. Booking a really expensive restaurant.
Have you ever seen someone get out a phone at dinner and, like, it's just a silent both of them scrolling or anything like that? What's some poor behaviour that you witness romantically?
I don't know. I don't go out that much. I'm like, I cook at home for my boo because I'm a romantic, you know, and also like to save money.
Yeah.
Do you have
a
go-to dish?
Go-to dish? I like steak. I've nailed steak.
Actually, cooking a good steak is impressive. I've got mussels. That's my...
Oh, that's so... Do you do it with the bread and the butter and the dipping? Oh, that's really good.
That's the only thing I can cook.
Actually, wait, I have another go-to dish. But this is like our special occasion thing, which is sushi.
Oh, right.
I can make like a hand roll. Yeah, because my dad's Japanese. And so every Saturday night we used to make hand roll sushi and get like fresh fish from the fish markets and all this stuff. And so, yeah, if I'm trying to impress someone.
Oh,
right.
That's delicious.
Yeah, you can also make sushi vegan, which you can't do with steak unless you do a vegan steak. But like
You can get the portobellos out, I guess.
Yeah, I guess.
It's not the same.
And you're recording a special?
I am. I'm recording my special tonight and tomorrow night at 6:30 at Comedy Republic. It's my 2024 show, Nina Oyama is Coming, and I'm never going to come again after this, I guess.
And that's what love is, yeah. Actually.
What's going on for Love Letters Live? What do you got teed up for us?
Well, I've got a fantastic lineup. Basically, Love Letters Live is a storytelling night where comedians read love letters. Some of them I think are going to be from, I'm going to read one from my actual past, which I actually wrote. And I think other people are writing, you know, funny love letters because, you know, comedians are afraid to be vulnerable. not me though. But yeah.
Hang on, your love letters.
My love. Yeah. I've got a love letter. It's very complicated. I dated someone who cheated on me a lot. It was the first time I've ever been like massively cheated on, like dated someone who was sleeping with like other people the whole time. It shattered my entire world, because I couldn't rely on him to give me the apology I wanted. I wrote it for him, and because I wanted to be a playwright at the time, I wrote this like apology with like stage directions. And incredible. Also the guy that I was dating was a former child actor, and I was like, you're an actor, act this. Well, I didn't say it like that. I think it was like, please read this apology because I can't trust any words that you're saying. So I'm gonna read that letter.
So have you ever had a table read for that one?
No, I haven't. I'm kind of terrified, but I think I'll do running commentary throughout because it's pretty funny because the letter is very complimentary to me. It's like, you're so funny. It's like, yeah, I wrote it. Like, yeah. It's so
good. Would you have taken the apology of the Norwegian skier this week who did it very publicly after winning a medal?
Like, absolutely not. That is dog behavior. That man sucks. Yeah. Like, what an awful man. And then trying to absolve himself by, like, you know, telling on himself in front of the whole world after winning.
So you don't think they're getting back together?
I mean, I hope not. But that said, I mean, what a great last Valentine's meal that would be. That guy's got sponsor money out the wazoo.
Yeah, he's going to be getting meals just thrown at him.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, free Adidas clothes. Like, I think, like, you
just
know,
cash
I feel
in
like
and get out.
Yeah, if she stays with him, it won't be because of the apology.
So can we drill down? So the in what ways that guy's humiliating declaration different from the dialogue that you assigned to your ex?
Well, my ex didn't tell anyone. He just carried on as normal, firstly, which I actually respect that more.
Dirty linen, that's the issue. Airing your dirty linen.
It's, yeah, fully airing of dirty linen. Thank God, that's such a hard phrase to say.
Yeah.
It's too early. But, yeah, I think it's sort of airing your dirty linen with an expectation to be, like, absolved.
And without, I guess, consulting whether she wanted that.
Yeah, I know. That's a public humiliation ritual is what I'd call it. I hope she survives.
What about how come you kept a copy of the letter? Was it written in a Word document or did you fax a copy? Or
it was written in a Google Drive. I was a very early converter to Google Drive because you don't have to save anything. So I just I Google drove that letter.
Yeah.
But yeah, I don't know. I just think it's like, it's because it was from a time when I was so sad, but also because it's like, it just is very funny in its own way, but I'm not going to read it to you now because I'm
naturally
saving it for Love Letters Live at the State Library of Victoria.
What about text communication or the flirting process or the courting process? Is that – it seems pretty fraught these days. Or is it – does it excite you? What do you have any view about flirting techniques and how people are going out there?
Oh, man. During COVID, I was listening to a podcast where it was like a Beverly Hills housewife talked about how she got hit on by Larry David.
What?
And she said it was really chill. They were like flirting. They were just at this party. And then he asked for her number and she told him her number and he didn't get out a phone or anything. He just took in her phone number and then they both went their separate ways, hung out at the party separately. And then when he was leaving, he came up to her and he was like, Bronwyn Kuss, 04, blah, blah, blah,
wow.
And just wrote, cited her phone number back at her, no phone, no visual cues, nothing. And she was like, that's the hottest thing. Like a man could ever do.
What a party trick. But
I know, but also he's very old. So I wonder if that's like sort of the standard when you hit your 60s, if it's just like, I can remember things, you know?
Yeah. No, but did he ever text? What the hell?
That would be insane if he like recited your phone number at you, left the party, never hear from Larry David ever again.
Just adding your phone number. He's just putting it in his like address book.
What about this idea that you want to be a dancer? How's that going?
That was from a long, very, very, very long time ago.
And it's dead now?
It's never dead. You can always dance. It exists at the club, I think. You know, then, but yeah, currently not really. I started bouldering. I feel like that's become my thing. Yeah, I know. I saw this Instagram that was like, you're in your 30s, choose your fighter, Pilates girl, run club, bouldering. And I was like, well, I guess I've chosen that fighter, but I love it. Like I could escape from anywhere.
I could
escape from a prison.
Do you do the thing though, where like I've had friends that boulder and they're like, it's actually a lot about problem solving. I am like, shut up.
It really is. Because it's like good for like your brain is solving a problem, but your body is also solving the problem with your brain. And I think I like it because you can do it over and over again until you get it right. And you're only competing against yourself and the person you were yesterday. So it's like, whereas I think sometimes in team sports, I get too competitive. And then if I'm not as good as someone, I like get really sad and really, I'm a sore loser.
What? Right. So yeah. In a team sport, not as good as someone, a teammate maybe?
As like a teammate or like as like the other team, or there's just too many competitors in the field. Whereas like with bouldering, you're only as good as your last boulder. So
is bouldering an okay first date, or is that crazy?
No, that's insane. Right. Also, like it's so much harder than you think it is, and also like. Yeah, I think I wouldn't take anyone bolt. But, like, also, all the first date things people do, I also don't date. I think I just, like, accidentally end up sleeping with people and then I get into
relationships.
And then
relationships. You don't leave their house, is that?
Yeah.
What's worse? Okay. What's the worst?
The free food.
Worst first date, bouldering or gig?
Oh, like a your comedy show. Gig. Mm-hmm. God, I think comedy is actually a good it's not a good first date because you don't get to know them, but you also, like, you can sit and watch it quietly. Whereas, like, bouldering, like, you have to scramble up a wall. And if you can't do a wall that's easy or someone can do the wall and you can't, like, you feel terrible. I'm in competition with everyone, including dates.
I kind of like the idea of just sweating your ass off on a date.
Yeah. I mean, yeah, it doesn't make sense to me because you can't really – I feel like when you're doing a wall, when you're climbing up a wall, you can't really, like, be connecting or telling a story. So then you're both sort of, like, taking turns, like, scrambling up the wall and getting sweaty and, like – it's not but maybe hot.
It's like a good way to just size them up and be like, if they can't climb up the wall, you're like, nah.
No, thank you.
No room.
I think bouldering, it's a good date if you're both already boulderers. And then I think it might be incredibly horny. You know, you climb the wall and then you climb each other. Yeah, like so sure. Many boulderers are like poly, you know, like there is that connotation.
Okay. Yeah. We're always learning on this show.
Yeah, we are. Yeah. If you're not laughing, you're learning.
Jase?
I think we've almost got to get out of here.
We do indeed. No. You can catch Nina Oyama in Love Letters Live alongside Alistair Baldwin, Mel O'Brien, anyone?
Says.
Yep.
Who does the toilet loo ratings.
Yeah. We love Beautiful. Says.
Beautiful. I love Says.
Okay.
And Lawrence Leung, I feel like.
Oh, really? Oh,
yes. I feel like he's on it.
We'll feel
and
him
And if
there.
He's not there, I'm sorry.
Yeah. You'll feel his presence. Don't worry.
Yeah.
That's going to be.
He's haunting the library. He's sitting in the corner reading A Court of Thorn and Roses.
Yeah. And that during that X knows that you're reading the letter?
Oh, no way. Yeah, I don't even think he thinks about me. Like, I think I was just like a blip on the radar
That's
of his
beautiful.
Life.
Beautiful. Well, go see Blip on the Radar, Nina Oyama, at the State Library, slv.vic.gov.au. Love Letters Live is the name of the event. Nina, great to see you again. Thanks very much.
Thank you.
Woo!
That's right. Triple R.
You've been listening to a podcast of the best bits of Breakfasters, which is the Monday to Friday breakfast show, broadcast live on Triple R from Melbourne, Australia. Feel free to get in touch with Breakfasters via Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, or via the Triple R website.